And welcome back to WRGW News. This is Above the Fold, this is a new show that we have here with two co-hosts from the GW Wonkcast, a podcast about public policy produced by graduate students from GW's Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. Here with us in the studio, we have students Eric Ladue and Gabe Moss. Let me turn on your mics, guys. All right, there you go. And tonight we will be discussing President Trump's proposed plans to revitalize America's collapsing infrastructure. Eric is going to talk to us about potential changes to regulations and how the administration plans to pay for these overdue and ignored upgrades. Next, Gabe will go into detail about the housing crisis and how the administration's infrastructure plan should contain specific provisions to support building more affordable housing. So first, let's everyone introduce themselves. Let's go around, starting with Eric. Just say hi.
Hello, my name is Eric Ladue. I'm a first-year MPA student at the Trachtenberg School, specifically studying program evaluation.
My name is Matthew Williams. I'm a freshman in the undergraduate college here at GW studying history and Arabic.
Right on.
All right. My name is Harris Kay, and I am a junior undergrad studying international affairs and Russian.
Cool. I'm Gabe. I'm MPP student, first year, and I'm trying to get close to my mic.
you got stuck with the cruddy mic.
Yeah.
If you want to move to the one closest right. to me, that'd be
yeah.
And while you're doing that, we can start our conversation on infrastructure. So Eric, you brought some articles. I'm gonna pass it off to you to start off.
Okay, great. I'd like to start with just doing a quick review of the background that this is coming from. Primarily, you all know that Donald Trump has spoken a lot about wanting to change policies and regulations so it would be easier for him to implement infrastructure change in America and update our infrastructure. This is coming looking what he was looking at when you look at his August 15th, 2017 executive order for streamlining environmental review processes. He proposes lowering the average time of those processes from which has so far been on average 7 years to 2 years. And following up with that, he also created an interagency task force on agriculture and rural prosperity. This was headed by the chairman Sonny Perdue, who's the head of USDA. And so far USDA has been at the forefront of doing a lot of this rural prosperity. That's an interesting theme we'll be going through here, which is emphasizing and specifically noting infrastructure for rural America. So what we have is there's a general plan that Trump posted, I believe it was January 8th, where he talks about, so guys, we're gonna generate $1.5 trillion in infrastructure spending over the next decade. Half of that is going to go towards incentivizing new state and local investments in infrastructure, half of the money that they would be using to generate that $1.5 trillion, and also using a quarter of that money that they want to create specifically dedicated for addressing rural infrastructure needs and prioritized by state and local leaders. So what's interesting about this is that really what Trump is really offering up so far has been when we've looked at a leaked memo that came out on January 22nd.
Not to be confused with today's leaked memo.
There are so many leaked memos.
The new Watergate, yes. Yeah. Thank you, Robert.
I'll refer to it as the leaked infrastructure plan. The basic outline of it is spending not $1.5 trillion, but spending $200 million to jumpstart acquiring and generating the $1.5 trillion. The point is that we're going to offer up this money to pay for up to 20% of infrastructure projects.
Wait, I'm sorry, $200 million to jumpstart more than $1 trillion?
Right.
So, not 200 billion, but 200 million.
It's all going to snowball, man. Don't worry about that.
200 million, and the idea, and what they're going off of here is that local governments and private investors will come in and pitch in the rest. And that's how it will become 1.5 million.
It's got me ready to run through brick walls. Let's go.
Yeah. So that's the money side of it. And really what he's also emphasizing is that he wants to create policy changes that would enable more of that infrastructure spending. And so this is looking at things like the plan will eliminate unnecessary redundancies and incentives in the regulatory and permitting process that are holding back American infrastructure development. There's also an idea to create a federal capital financing fund, which imagine a fund that agencies borrow from to immediately pay for projects if they don't have the money on hand. Most federal money is kept track of in real dollars. It's a more complicated thing. There's a whole write-up on it at OMB. But creating a fund that agencies could borrow money from to do immediate purchases or immediate payment for projects, and then they pay that fund back. As well as, this one showed up in the leaked report, allowing for the disposition of real federal property to allow better allocation of economic resources and infrastructure projects. The basic idea is, well, you know, if it seems like if we want this bridge built, we need to sell some land to a private developer. Okay, let's do it.
So, like, whenever the president, he likes to talk about his, whenever he talks about infrastructure, he always talks about how years ago it used to take, like, a year to get a permit, and now it takes, like, 10 years. Is this, like, the same deal that you're talking about, like, this new plan?
Yeah, this idea is all that. So this is all part of that idea of making it easier to get financing into these development projects. And what's kind of unspoken, and what I haven't mentioned yet, is some of his ideas. First off, I want to mention, again, the idea behind the $200 million, which will magically become $1.5 million, is that no more than 20% of that it will pay for no more than 20% of any project. So how do you get the money for this? And what they've talked about is, well, potentially one system we could do is we offer grants to help private contractors rebuild a bridge. They can then, as another incentive, not only have they been paid to build the bridge, but we will also allow them to collect a toll on it. So can you imagine having a contractor that you hire to fix your door, but then by the end of it, you have to pay him every time you use your door, and you've paid him to fix it?
I saw some stuff, too, about interstate highways being tolled, which really alarms me, because, I mean, we're talking about a country with almost no worker mobility, and the main way to find new job is to drive your car to a new place and get a new job to relocate your family or maybe to commute. But if there's now a toll on that road, say $2 every way, you're paying $4 a day. That's half an hour's worth of work just to get to work, right? So this isn't something that benefits anyone besides the wealthy company that's able to invest in making the road. It's, you could say, regressive, hurting the low-income consumer.
All right, if you don't like the driving, you've pulled to a rest stop. I didn't mention that I also want to privatize the rest stops.
Really?
I don't know. So there's some nasty rest stops out there. I was curious, though, just about the memo, because it was a leaked memo, so I'm taking that as, like, the Trump White House hasn't, like, actually put this forward. This is largely speculation based off of what people think it'll do. Like, it's not...
This is potentially a rough draft, but I will say I went and confirmed from another official document. As you know, at whitehouse.com, they have many, they create a lot of fact sheets that will say, you know, this is what the president supports, and this is the rough outline of what we want to do. And to confirm with you right now, we do know the general plan is that they want to generate the infrastructure spending, not spend actually $1.5 trillion. So I was looking at an OMB budget fact sheet that was labeled for 2018, and it has kind of this outline of ideas that they want to look into, and some of these are reflected in this document. There are other ideas that exist in this OMB document that talk about things like creating systems so that you only need to get approval from one federal agency instead of, you know, you go talk to EPA, and then maybe you need to go talk to a different federal agency before you can start a construction project. I'm sure they're still pursuing that, and this document you're looking at right now is only 6 pages. There's probably other missing pages there. Another idea is transmitting permitting processes to the hands of, quote, responsible state and local governments. And also, a fun one that I think is kind of ominous, the judicial reform idea, which is usually when you have a permitting process to do construction or to do something with infrastructure, there's often, on top of the environmental review, you have to do a judicial review to make sure that the permit that you give out is litigation proof. And I quote here, "The administration believes our resources would be better spent on enhancing the environment rather than feeding needless litigation. As such, the administration will submit proposals that curtail needless litigation." That's sort of, I hear that and I hear there's going to be some policy to make sure that you can't litigate a government-executed permit for some construction project.
What government construction projects do you think might need litigation?
Well, imagine you want to build a new off-ramp from a freeway and it happens to go over someone's house.
Or say you invest in something like a themed casino in Atlantic City and you just decide that you don't want to pay your contractors.
Oh, no.
I don't know who that might be. But then the contractors sue you, but because you have support from certain local governments, maybe it's now exempt from litigation, perhaps.
Hmm.
I don't know.
The wording about their intent is left a little bit vague there.
The right. Big question that I have is that if the government's only going to put up, like, let's say, like 20% or whatever, and I feel like this is strange because the places that are affected the worst by bad infrastructure are probably poor places that even if the government's putting up 20%, still probably couldn't afford to do their infrastructure. You know, it seems to help those that can already kind of afford it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Flint, Michigan. Or right. A lot of other places where there's more. This is going to cost way more than the local government can afford to pay for. 20%, great, that's helpful if we can somehow find the rest of the money.
All right, so we're about halfway through the show, so we're going to... is there anything else you want to add, Eric, to the infrastructure issue for today's episode?
I think what
episode?
We've reviewed has spoken for itself.
Okay. So now we're going to transition over to Gabe Moss, who did a lot of research on the affordable housing crisis, how it intersects with infrastructure policy. So, Gabe, take it away.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is kind of just the missing part of Trump's infrastructure bill is the lack of any sort of investment into public housing stock, affordable housing stock, or really any sort of encouragement for even public-private partnership in developing affordable housing. So this trend kind of began, I'm going to say, with Clinton was the first time that we had really a shift from bricks and mortar, public policy led by HUD, where you have new buildings being built with the intent of them being used for public housing, and you shift to voucher systems and other relief methods for helping people find housing if they can't afford market rate housing. My problem with this whole atmosphere about affordable housing is that it's not existent in any capacity. So I went to the Senate hearing with Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, this past week, and sitting there and listening to him talk about the president's plan for this infrastructure bill, he didn't mention affordable housing at all. And a senator asked him, "What about affordable housing? My state needs a bunch of affordable housing infrastructure development. What can you tell me about that?" And he essentially said, "That is not something the president is seriously considering right now, and it is not overtly in the bill." Not that it couldn't be, but that it just hasn't been part of the conversation. And this is kind of reinforced by the leaked bill not mentioning anything about it, and the State of the Union address, which was given this week, not mentioning it at all either. And you might think this isn't that big of an issue, but if you look at most large cities, D.C. included, you have a severe lack of affordable housing. Right, DC's area median income is above $60,000, and that's usually used as the target base point for deciding how to support affordable housing in the city. So you have new affordable units that are built are set at, say, 80% area median income, 50% area median income, 30% area median income, whatever it might be. But the problem is those units, because the area median income is so high, often can't actually even be taken by the people that really need them. And they go to middle income folks who are already paying far too much for their housing anyway, and quite frankly deserve some sort of support. But the point is that the policy doesn't actually reach the people that need it. And a large part of that is that there isn't enough housing stock to go around for the people that are in the city. Most of the developments are either high end or business developments. The city right now is looking into converting unused office space into housing, so that might help. But again, they're not getting any support from HUD. They're not expecting any investment into affordable housing from the federal government. So DC City is having to actually take this on by themselves. And in other cities like Los Angeles, this is even more pronounced, where over half the population rents. Of that renting population, over half pays more than 30% of their monthly income on rent. Half of that, again, so 25%, pay more than 50%. And of the people paying more than 75%, they're primarily people of color. So it's a system that is both classist and also racist, and designed to subjugate and segregate and do all this sort of stuff.
So, Gabe, real for the benefit of our listeners real quick.
Yeah.
So in the past, has HUD come in and built housing themselves, like using their money to actually build the buildings? Or like, how does that work real quick? Just so.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when public housing was first considered back, in the 1920s through 1940s, the approach was called bricks and mortar, which is basically the government goes and builds a building or works with a contractor to build a building for the expressed purpose of investing in public housing and making affordable housing for low-income individuals. This is not the golden era of public housing by any means. I don't want to give that impression. These houses were intentionally built to fall apart. They were built as poorly as possible. They got the same people who designed prisons to come in and design the layouts of the buildings in a lot of cases. It is not something that anyone should aspire to recreate. I mean, a lot of these buildings had elevators that only stopped at every other floor and were awful, because the prevailing spirit was, if you encourage poor people to become rich by making their housing terrible, you don't need to make it last that long because it will be so bad that people will find median income jobs and move into real housing. So that persists. Those buildings start breaking down. There is reinvestment into it through the 50s, through the 60s, but you get into the 70s and the 80s and the culture shifts to the point where now there is no overt investment into new public housing. A lot of what we see is joint public and private partnerships where the government will say, hey, look, we have this rule that says you can only build, say, 100 units in this apartment building in a specific lot. But if you build 8% of them to be affordable, meaning they are offered at lower than market rates, we'll let you build 8 free units. You know, so there's special workarounds for private businesses to be able to build some affordable units in mixed income housing, which is good. That's not bad, but what's awful is the HUD and the executive office just haven't included any language on that even, and haven't even bothered looking into that. So, it's anyone's guess if that's going to be something that's really brought up in the future.
Do you think that, I mean, maybe the, we've seen a pretty, I'd say drastic increase in the economy and the strength of the economy since President Trump took office, see lower unemployment numbers, especially African-American unemployment at its lowest since 72.
Check that, Jay-Z.
Do you think, and you have a large, tax bill come through with cuts across all brackets, do you think they're maybe counting on increased economic, improvement to minimize some of the need for affordable housing and leaning more on that?
They could be. I am really skeptical about those measures. There's issues I have with how they've calculated the tax benefit, in that it's across entire quintiles. So it's for everyone in the bottom 20%, what has changed, right? It's not specific to different regions. It's not specific to different, family sizes or income statuses or whatever. So I mean, I am skeptical about the benefit of the tax bill. I'm also skeptical about talking about unemployment, because a lot of what's going on with employment is really hard to capture in an unemployment figure, which doesn't account for people who have just given up on finding traditional work.
Jobless rate.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So there's issues with all that. But that aside, it is possible that they're hoping that this increase in economic activity will boost the housing market. That if you lower restrictions on permits, just generally, maybe it'll be easier for contractors to actually just build houses. I think that that is overly optimistic. I think when you're talking about a place like Los Angeles with over 10 million people living in the county, there's no amount of growth, if it's 1%, if it's 5% for the middle income brackets, there's no amount of growth that will generate a new housing market.
It's interesting to me that Los Angeles gets brought up just because you have a far more liberal government, I guess, in Los Angeles than you would see in the state of California than you would see the way that Trump is running, obviously, the executive branch. But in California, homeless rates have skyrocketed and really have taken up, you know, now places like Los Angeles are beating out the homeless rates in New York and, you know, larger East Coast. Yeah, DC, you know, larger East Coast cities. And I don't know a lot about policy, but I didn't know, you know, if that would have different ways to view that.
Yeah, so Los Angeles is, to its credit, trying to do something about this. They've earmarked billions of dollars worth of funding to go to investment into public housing, just straight up building new buildings, helping private owners build mixed income units. Their only target is 10,000 to 15,000 units. And we're talking about 5 million people who pay too much for rent, right? It has the highest rate of doubled up young people in the West Coast. I don't know about nationally, but it's incredibly common for people to be living in situations that traditionally we would not consider to be appropriate, right? Where you're living two people to a room, two families to a unit. Now, that we might need to reconsider that just moving forward if that's appropriate, but that is something that traditionally we've seen as being subpar. So even if you double the housing stock, you might not actually increase the rate of the housed population, because you might just see people expanding out from cramped living quarters into a more appropriate living situations. It's also worth noting that in Los Angeles, there's so little funding for the housing voucher program to help people compete in higher income housing markets that since 2004, housing vouchers have only been offered once. It was last October. They were opened for several weeks. 20,000 people were chosen by lottery to apply to get a housing voucher, not even given a housing voucher. Also, housing vouchers don't let people who have criminal histories apply. They are like SNAP or TANF, where if you have a criminal record, you can't apply. If you are found doing drugs at all on the premises of a housing voucher home, you are kicked out. So it's something that really doesn't benefit a lot of people that absolutely need help. Eric, you're looking like you want to say something.
Just that policy about how if you have a criminal record, you can't get SNAP. I'm like, well,
yeah, what are you supposed
to
do?
Get your leg up. It sounds like, okay, well, I'm going to go back to crime then.
Well, yeah, so if, and it's really twisted, if they find out that someone that is living with you has a criminal record, that can be grounds for losing your housing voucher, for losing your food support, for losing your family support. So it's absolutely a system that is designed to keep people trapped in cycles of poverty and cycles of prison. It's no coincidence that California has a three strikes rule and has, on average, 103% capacity for its prisons. Although, you know, I'm not going to go more into statistics because I just don't have the numbers in front of me. But it is disproportionately disadvantaging people of color, disproportionately disadvantaging Black people specifically. It is not a good situation to be poor in Los Angeles. Or really anywhere in the country.
And sorry, I'm going to jump in right there, because with that, we're almost out of time, guys. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
is there anything anyone wants to throw in real quick before we wrap it up for tonight? Nah?
It's all good.
I think it was a great first episode of Above the Fold. This was like a great collaboration between WRGW News and the Trachtenberg School Wancast podcast. And I'm just going to read my script because I think it has all the information that I need. GW1Cast airs new episodes every Wednesday where they discuss a range of policy issues and all things wonky. You can follow and subscribe to GW1Cast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, or check out their Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram pages. I've checked them out. They are absolute fire, so definitely follow them. It's some pretty fun and interesting content. Their handle is at GW1Cast, so check them out. And we hope to see you, or hope you tune in next Friday at 6:30 for another episode of Above the Fold. Thank you, and have a good night.